Welcome to the House of Strauss.
Yeah, go for it.
Stars hang with stars, winners hang with winners.
Si un jour tu m'emmènes à la plage, j'aimerais t'en plonger dans les vagues. Je te promets que je resterai sage, mais tu ne comprends pas que je rêve de ça.
It is House of Strauss. I am joined by Jason Timpf of the Hoops Tonight YouTube channel, and you have seen him likely with Colin Cowherd if you are a fan of basketball in any depth. Jason, it's nice to meet you finally in this particular format.
It's nice to meet you too, man. You're someone that I've admired for a long time from afar, not just for your work, which is obviously excellent, but also just the entire way you've approached this industry over the course of the last few years. I think this time in this industry is a time that you have to be adaptable and you have to be willing to try different things. And honestly, it's something I've always respected about the Volume. I think they've been kind of a little bit ahead of the curve on some stuff too, and just the way that they distribute content. But just what you've done with House of Strauss and with your Substack, I think is super impressive and inspiring to all of the people that are trying to get a foothold in this industry.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say. And I think that's what this conversation is going to be about. Not me. That's not what the conversation is going to be about, but it's going to be about media. And hopefully it's going to be a bit of a respite, because you work your ass off, man, talking about the NBA. And I know that's what you're doing right now with just full commitment. So I'm hoping that we can go a little more 30,000 foot in this conversation, because for those who do not know, this is actually the first conversation I've had with Jason. Oh my God, how lucky are you, listener? You are listening to literally the first conversation that I'm having with Jason Timpf. Incredible, your good fortune. And it's because I think you sort of came out of nowhere. Other people in the industry, I had seen them on the circuit. I was on the beat, and I would see them at arenas, and I would see them maybe at Summer League. You somehow got in through some side door to where I was eventually texting friends of mine going, who is this guy? And he's really good. And they go, yeah, he's really good. I like what he's doing. And we almost don't know. We don't know where you arrived from, Jason. And I feel like, because we're talking about an industry, it's a hard industry. It's hard to get in. It's hard to make money, but there are opportunities. You seem like you're somebody who has paved his own way, and I'm monologuing a lot before I give you a chance to talk, but I will read something. I read it in Barrett Sports on you, and whoever wrote it, I don't know who the writer is, but he actually did a really good job. I mean, article rated as The Lost Art. He really built up the drama of your life. I will get through these two paragraphs and then I will allow you to speak, Jason. But it says, there was once a time when Jason Timpf always included Colin Cowherd in his commute to work. As he made his morning drive to a sales job at Verizon, the herd was appointment listening each morning for Timpf. The ex-college basketball player would marvel at Cowherd's ability to make relatable references and break down all of the same basketball games he would watch the night before. One of the unique things Timpf can remember from listening to The Herd during that time was Cowherd saying if Fox ever put someone in front of him, he could tell in 5 seconds if that individual had the skills to be a host. It was far from a hot take on the Lakers, but still a distinct moment that stuck with Timpf for many years. Little did he know at the time, but Cowherd would soon give a 5-second evaluation of Timpf's career. What drama! Oh my God.
Man, it's so funny, because I was literally working a sales job. It's funny. I got done playing in college, and I was playing in Phoenix at an NAIA school up there. And when I came back home, I immediately was just kind of looking for a job. And so I ended up getting a sales job at Verizon Wireless and pretty quickly became good at it. And then I got promoted in less than a year to a management position. And so I was like, basically the dude with the slacks and the dress shoes that was like managing a sales team. And I was so miserable. I hated it so much. And I wanted to do something different. And so I kind of made a decision that I was going to, I wanted to work in basketball in some way, shape, or form. And my first kind of pathway there was trying to play overseas. And I kind of pursued that for a couple of years. Had an opportunity, but then the league that I was agreeing to go play for like folded. And then I was like, all right, I'm done. I'm gonna pivot and go into the sports media space. And so I looked for a really flexible career to help me pursue that. That ended up being real estate so that I could basically manage to make enough money to pay the bills while having the flexibility to do what I wanted to do. And ironically, at the beginning, it was a slog because I was like listening to all of the establishment advice, you know, like go bang on the door of a radio station, see if you can work a soundboard and maybe you'll get an opportunity to hop in on a Saturday, you know, or something like that.
Go climb a ladder to a tower that doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. And there was even a like a sports media school out in Charlotte where I was living at the time. My wife and I briefly moved out to Charlotte for a couple of years. And in Charlotte, I attended this like kind of like orientation for the school, and it was like absurdly expensive, like outrageously expensive. And all they were really going to do is give you an opportunity to practice being a media professional. Like you'd work in their kind of like fake studio and you'd write articles and stuff like that. And I was literally like, I can't afford to risk this kind of money on something like this. And so ironically, I kind of got a little discouraged at that point. But Twitter ended up saving the day for me. So like my wife and my friends and my family, they are not basketball fans. Ironically, my wife played in college too. She's one of those people that played in college. And then when she was done, she was like, actually, I'm sick of this. I don't want to do anything with it anymore. So I just kind of used Twitter as an outlet just to talk about basketball, you know? And circa about 2016, Logan Swaim, who if I remember correctly, was actually a producer at FS1 at that point, was doing something with Colin at FS1. And he just started following me on Twitter. And he was actually just a Laker fan that I would occasionally interact with. And I didn't even realize he was working in the industry. But over the course of time, that's just kind of like a stage setter. Because late 2020, early 2021, I got invited by, you know who Jason Maples is?
Yeah, Coach Maples.
Yeah, love Maples. Just doing incredible things in the basketball community too for kids. And he invited me to come on the Temple of Hoop podcast as a guest. And I did it once and was like, this is awesome. I love this. This is how I want to do it. And so I literally that next day went on Amazon, bought a microphone, bought a little webcam, and just started doing stuff on Twitter. And that was kind of the birth of the Jason Timpf podcast, so to speak. And then we just basically used the free tools that were available. I partnered with Raj to do instant reactions after Lakers games too. Chipolo is a guy who covers the Lakers with Vinay Kilawala. They do a really good job as well. And I partnered with him and we did post game reactions. But honestly, the thing that I feel like everyone's got like their like luck, their stroke of luck that they get. And the big one for me was Twitter Spaces. It you know how Twitter's like a remarkably weak algorithm? Like you have to get a retweet for something to get shared. Whereas with Instagram and TikTok and YouTube, watch time drives your content to strangers, right?
Yeah.
So Twitter doesn't have that, but they briefly did with Twitter Spaces. And Twitter Spaces is still operating now, but at the time in that early phase, essentially, if you listened to a Twitter space, all of your followers would see that space. And so it was like a wildfire algorithm because any single person who entered the space was promoting it to every single one of their followers at the top of the feed. And so we started hitting like insane numbers during the Russell Westbrook fiasco of the Lakers. And we actually crashed Twitter Spaces one night. And when we crashed it, I got a direct message from Logan and he was like, hey man, like let's do this. And I didn't even realize that he was working with the volume at that point. And honestly, it was just kind of a dream come true because I was hoping for a breakthrough with like something like Blue Wire or some kind of like lower level podcast platform where I could make a little bit of money. And to get the opportunity to work with not just Colin, but a company that is so forward thinking and so on top of some of the newer advantages you can get in this industry. That was my big stroke of luck for sure.
I had no idea about the spaces aspect of it. That's fascinating to me. And I don't use spaces, but it's interesting when it becomes part of the conversation, how Nick Wright, about a week or so ago, hopped on Twitter Spaces to argue with Warriors fans after the Warriors got eliminated. And
brave man.
Even if they might have negative opinions about Nick, I think there was this sense of respect that he had come into the Lions' den and he had defended his point of view right there. And it had me thinking, huh, should I actually engage in this world and deal with whatever's in there? I don't know. That's very TBD. The volume, I think, is really good about the instant reaction or the quick reaction. And that's not easy to do because there's usually a quality versus speed trade-off. I know I hated it when ESPN would want me to have a recap on the Warriors up 5 minutes after the buzzer. That felt like too much. But before, when it was about an hour, that was something that I could... I could manage that. It worked. I think that's such a sweet space for a lot of fans of any sport because the game is over. There's still a buzz about whatever's happening. They want content right then. And there's still, I think there aren't enough people or there isn't enough content for people in that moment when they're hungriest. How have you gone about attacking the reaction space?
So initially that was all we did. Like even with State of the Lakers before I started with the volume, like it was just every night after the Lakers game, we would go. And shout out to people like my wife who put up with that during that time, like to talk about needing to believe, because like three, four nights a week, like instead of hanging out with her, I was watching a Lakers game and going live on Twitter, right? And, you know, initially with the volume, we actually, and to their credit, they pivoted quickly when the spaces, because Twitter Spaces to me is a really bizarre platform, because like they'll get these huge numbers in some of these rooms, but I don't know how you could really monetize it just with the it's kind of like the Wild West in so many different ways. And so it's kind of tricky, but we initially continued the Twitter Spaces thing and then we bailed on that because we didn't see it as monetizable as YouTube, essentially. But in the early years of, because we started as Lakers Tonight, that was the original pitch of the show, right? Like we're just going to take Lakers Tonight. Now I made it clear to Logan right when we were talking. I was like, look, this is fine, but my goal is to cover the league. Like I have no intention of being a Lakers specific guy. I want to be a guy who covers the league. And so he was like, okay, well, we'll go under the Lakers Tonight banner and then we'll just do other content as well. And then they eventually came up with like basically a second marketing package, which was Hoops Tonight. But the show is still branded as Lakers Tonight. And then after that first playoff run was when we actually rebranded the entire show. But during that first initial phase, we were going every night. And you're right, like it's difficult. There's value in instant reaction, but there's a lack of depth. And I wanted to be able to kind of do both. And so we shifted as we went into, it started in the postseason because we started doing morning film sessions. So like we'd cover the night game and then the morning we'd do a film session. And we'd cover the night game and then in the morning we'd do a film session. And that allowed me to like hit the instant reaction audience, but then also make sure I had the depth to back up the things that I was trying to say. And then honestly, like what's been nice is now we've reached the point where we have enough of an established base that during the regular season, I don't have to go that crazy. So we'll target one or two games a week as an instant reaction type of thing. But for the most part, it's during the day. Because I do think if you don't have that depth and quality, there's a certain cheapness and lack of sustainability. So you've got to have both. But that to me is the entire like mission statement of the volume and why I think they're so smart. Like there's the content piece, but then there's the distribution piece, and the content piece that's so unique to the person who's hosting the show, right? But the distribution piece, there are certain things that everybody needs to be doing, like not just the instant reaction, but got to be on YouTube. Like it's amazing to me how many shows out there are still not using YouTube. It is a free advertising platform. Yeah. You know, it is it has great monetization built in. There's so many things about YouTube that are useful. I think the volume is great with social media content. I think like they're great with one of the things the volume will do is they'll take my show and like I'll be in the weeds for 85% of it, but they'll market it around the 15% that is more palatable to the masses, which I think is really smart because you pull them in with that. And then I act like normal and authentic myself on the show, you know? And I just, they taught me so much about how to kind of take advantage of the tools that are available to you. And I don't think the volume success over the last couple of years is a coincidence.
I don't think so either. I'll definitely need some tips because we have a YouTube channel, but I only really know how to make money off my newsletter format. I don't know the tricks of the trade. I admire you YouTube stars who have figured it out. Maybe that's a good question for you. What would your advice be on being a presenter of content in that format? And then additionally, was there anything from sales that was at all useful in that context?
So, you know, it's funny. I was listening to Colin and Nick Wright the other day, and they had their part two of their most recent episode. They were talking about advice, right? And one of the things that Colin said is like, my advice isn't necessarily going to work for every kid out there. So he doesn't really believe in it. But him and Nick got into it a little bit. And Nick actually kind of pitched the idea of basically like, just do it, like just make content. And it's funny because that's always been my ethos. I'm a big believer in like fake it till you make it, essentially, when it is, I think, is the best pathway these days. Because of the free tools, it's like impossible for someone who's talented to not get discovered as long as they're using the free tools, because the algorithm promotes quality. That's the most beautiful thing about this system, is like someone clicks your video and they watch it for a while, it is going to power the algorithm to push it further out and further out, right? And so like my advice to literally anybody who's trying to get this off the ground at this point, whether you're a movie critic or you're into politics or you're into sports or whatever it is you do, like just start making content and get it out there.
Totally agree.
As far as the algorithm goes, I'm a big believer in like multiple cracks at it. So for instance, one of the things that we do at The Volume, which I think is really smart, is we'll take the full show and we'll put it out. Then what we do is we basically just target, because like you have a character limit on the YouTube title, right? And then you have only so much eye candy that you can put in a thumbnail, right? So, but if you're doing six topics in a show or five topics in a show, you're not going to be able to get all of that in the thumbnail. And so just take every segment and break it out, market it, put it on YouTube, because you're effectively giving yourself multiple cracks at the algorithm. And so we'll have breakout clips that don't do well. You know, they might just do 2,000 or 3,000 views, whatever, you know. But then we'll have like usually like 3-4 times a week, we'll have a breakout clip, just a random segment that catches the algorithm and gets going and gets, you know, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 views, just as like free money on in addition to a show we've already released. And so I think it's just all it really is optimization of the tools that are available.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like you're at a butcher shop where you can sell a whole cow and then somehow be able to still sell pieces and different cuts of the cow. And it doesn't really impact your bottom line. That's quite an advantage. The only disadvantage is that there's so much competition in the space, so many people competing for eyeballs, that it's hard to really break through. That's difficult. And it's still a bit of a mystery to me as to what resonates and what works and what people are even looking for. Do you have any theories on that? Or has this just been, I'm going to continue to grind, I'm going to continue to work, and I'm going to succeed because of that?
So that's the second piece of it, is like, I'll just be straight up. If my entire life was just shifted backward 10 years, I'm probably in sales right now. You know, like that's just the reality of the way that this new kind of influx of tools has given me an opportunity. So there's a blessing and a curse with that, because the blessing is the opportunity, but the curse is everyone's doing it now, right? And so you're right. Like, it's just completely and totally flooded. Even just like, I even think it's interesting just with the former professional athletes. Like, there are so many athlete podcasts now, but it's because it's easy to get one out. You don't need to approach ESPN or some media entity and be like, hey, can you please let me have a show? No, you can go right now and make one. Anybody can do it. And so that kind of makes the marketplace flooded. And so you have to find a way to separate yourself at the end of the day. And so I think a big chunk of it is work ethic. So like, one of the big ones for me, every NBA pod that I listened to, and there's a bunch of guys out there that were important to me, like Bill Simmons was a huge one for me, just him being just a historian of the game. I read his book, and that shaped a lot of my initial kind of impression of NBA history. Obviously, Zach Lowe, Kevin O'Connor, there's a bunch of guys out there that I looked at in the early phase of my kind of like wanting to go down this route that I admired and respected. But the vast majority of them are doing two or three episodes a week.
Yeah,
and now one of the differences in their format is they don't really do individual games. They do big picture stuff. So it's like, hey, Tuesday show, we're going to talk. Today, we're going to talk the Central Division. Or today, we're going to talk, we're going to do half Mavs and half, the Suns or whatever, right? Like, and then they'll do a big picture and they'll talk about that team within the context of the last couple of weeks. And they basically run through that cycle, and that allows them to kind of like hit all of the teams. And so one of the tools that we used is we used games as the framework for the analysis. So like if we cover a TNT slate on a Tuesday and there's four major market teams that are playing, we'll do an instant reaction to both games. But in that, in my prep, I'll research how they've been playing over the course of the last couple of weeks, and we'll basically effectively do that, but frame it around the game. So we get the benefit of the instant reaction kind of like algorithm bump, right? But then we also have daily topics. It gives us a daily news cycle to cover. And so essentially, like, what I think is interesting about Hoops Tonight is it is a daily NBA show, which is just something that you don't see terribly often out there. So I think that's been kind of like a little niche that we've been able to slip into and have some success.
Yeah, I mean, you got to work like hell to do that. I hope you treat yourself to a nice vacation or give yourself some sort of balance, because at least from my perspective, that just seems very hard. But I say it from the perspective of somebody who is on the beat and maybe burned out for other reasons. The balance of what's a driver for you and what is sustainable quality, I think, is always difficult for anybody in this space. They call it audience capture, where you're captured by your audience. According to one of my sources, Jason, I don't know it to be true, but you're around 30% of your audience on YouTube is in the Philippines. That was just one of my sources told me that. And there's a lot of fandom for the Lakers and for the Warriors there. Obviously, those are teams that are good to tilt towards whoever you are, but how do you balance that of talking about teams that have that big audience resonance with trying to cover the league holistically?
So that is literally the advantage of going as often as we do. And so think of it like this. Imagine it as the two or three episode a week format where we bounce around the league and keep a good variety, but then we're basically adding an extra, let's just say double the amount of content. We're adding that and just hitting the cash cows over and over and over again. And that's basically what it is. And honestly, like, that was definitely a volume thing that they kind of taught me. And it's a strategy that we stuck with. But essentially, it's actually kind of funny, because I have this reputation of being a Lakers guy or a Warriors guy, or a guy that like hammers the same teams over and over again. And I absolutely do. But I do so many episodes, and so, like, we do roughly 3-4 hours of content a week, like at least on average. During the playoffs, it's insane, but we do these 3-4 hours of content a week. So like, yeah, there's, an hour and a half, 2 hours of Lakers, Warriors, Celtics, the big cash cow type of fan bases. But then the other 2.5 hours is the methodical coverage of the rest of the league. And so I'm used to it. I'm used to getting some feedback where it's like, man, you always talk about the Lakers, you always talk about the Warriors, but it's like, I'm at peace with it because I know I put the work in on the other teams as well. It's just, to me, that's about money making. Like, that's all it is. Like, at the end of the day, we do this to pay the bills. And so there's a kind of like moral compass that points people in the direction of being fair in the distribution of their coverage, which I totally respect and understand. But I just kind of want to split that difference there and do both. Yeah. And one last thing, I want to shout out Ryan Brumley here. He was my first producer when I started with The Volume, and he still is one of our executive producers. But they stuck in with me as someone who's brand new, right? And he did such an amazing job of helping me feel comfortable in a really bizarre situation, obviously, because I didn't have any media experience and I walked into this. And he has helped me navigate that work-life balance piece, because I killed myself that first year. I literally did not. I worked on vacation. We went traveling and I worked. I was on a cruise ship in Alaska working, which, by the way, was stupid and I should not have done that. But that's what I was doing. And I've found better balance now. We find openings in the schedule to take time off. I'm taking tonight off. In the first two playoff runs, I barely ever took a night off in the postseason. Yeah. And last year in the summer, I took 16 consecutive days off for vacation. So Ryan has done a good job of, you said audience capture, and it's so interesting. I've never heard that term before, but that's literally what it is. It's like you almost get caught up in the growth and you feel an obligation to produce. You almost feel like you owe it to your listeners for supporting you to give them this unrelenting wave of content. And there's also this deep anxiety that you feel sometimes when you're not working, because you feel like you're leaving meat on the bone and people are gaining ground on you. It's tough. It really is a part of this business that I did not expect to have to deal with, but you know, it is what it is.
No, it's I've had these conversations with my wife, and I think I've gotten to the point where this newsletter feels like I've got a solid base where I'm not really sweating what happens week to week, but it does feel like the margin between blowing up and having a real voice, a lot of presence, and frankly, a lot of money, and nobody really listening to you or knowing about you, it feels like such a small margin between those two things. And it's hard not to feel that pressure when you're not working and you know you always could be. You could always conceivably be doing something. So it's difficult. I'm wondering, where does your work ethic come from? That's the first thing people are talking about. Is this guy, well, he's really good, but it's also, there's just so much. Does that come from your parents? Is that just something that was always in you?
I'm going to put it very simply. It's 100% derived from my love of basketball. I actually hate this about myself, but I am the textbook guy that is lazy about something if he doesn't care about it. And I had so many bad qualities. I often talk with my friends and family, like I, in so many ways, like getting this type of opportunity was something that I almost needed, because I was the kind of guy that would just get so bored. And I just couldn't, I had a hard time applying myself to things that didn't really invigorate me in terms of how much I care about what I'm doing. Like, for instance, like when I was coming out of high school, I immediately got accepted into the engineering school at the U of A, at University of Arizona. And I had like this career track in front of me to be an engineer. But I just didn't like it. And so I was lazy. And so I literally failed out of the U of A in a year. it was bad. I just wasn't a good student. And like, I, ironically, you know what made me a good student was basketball. So I was a late bloomer. I was a terrible high school basketball player, just absolutely horrific. The story I always tell is we had 6 seniors on my varsity team. And on senior night, 5 of those seniors started and played minutes. I didn't see the floor. And that usually is considered like, that's the night when you let the bad senior play, you know?
And you're what? You're 6'6", 6'7", something in that neighborhood?
Yeah, I'm like 6'6" and a half of shoes on. And then I have pretty long arms. I was gifted with some good natural basketball ability, but I was a late bloomer. I didn't really become an athlete until I was like 19. And so I was a really bad high school basketball player. And I grew up in a family that was big on football and baseball. So I didn't really get exposed to basketball. It's actually how I became a LeBron fan. I happened to click on a game that had LeBron playing and he won me over. And then I fell in love with basketball. And the, you know, the rest is history. But like my third year of college, I walked into an open gym at the local JUCO here in town and I just killed everybody. And so then they offered me a scholarship on the spot. And so I approached my parents and I'm like, hey, like I want to do this. And they supported me. And so then I go through training camp and we're working our way through the season. And I get called into the office and they're like, hey, you know, you can't play, right? Like your grades are terrible. Like, what are you doing? You know? And so I had this insane track from there. I had to sit out the first semester. Over winter break, I had to take a full class load over winter break to get eligible for the spring semester, played. Then I got offered a scholarship by a better junior college, basically a basketball factory down by the border called Cochise College. Just imagine a basketball powerhouse at the JUCO level, but like stuck in the middle of the Arizona desert. Like that's in the middle of nowhere. And so then one day that coach approaches me and is like, you're not eligible for year two. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like I went to all this school and they're like, well, for year two, they take the average of your previous, it was some weird rule so that summer I had to turn around and take a full class load. And so it was so funny because I went from being this like awful student who was super lazy to a guy that was like getting really good grades and taking this insane class of basketball.
I'm fascinated by this because you're clearly a sharp guy. Did you think you were dumb? I mean, what was the whole, what was the narrative that you told yourself about where you were at and where you were headed?
I just was a lost kid, man. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I didn't have anything that gave me that inspiration to work hard, like we're talking, like we're kind of talking about. And that's how special basketball is to me. Basketball literally fixed my terrible, terrible study habits and turned me into a good student, right? Mm. And so that I tell that story just to kind of set the framework in the sense that when I started in the sports media space, it's just easy for me to work hard in this space. That's the only way that I can put it. Basketball is just, it's given me literally everything I have in my life. It gave me the most exciting moments of my youth in college basketball. It gave me my school paid for over the course of that stretch of time. It gave me some of the experience post basketball in terms of the pursuit of overseas opportunities and money tournaments and all these kinds of things. And even just now, I'm 32 now, I'm a better basketball player than I've ever been. And I love it. And I approach it like a pro every single day, just because of how much I love the game. Like I literally go through a weight training and skills training regimen on a daily basis for no damn reason other than the fact that I like being good at this shit. Like that's literally all it is. And so it pushes me. It is my number one driver of everything I do every day.
Are you annoyed that you didn't have that mentality when you were younger? Because, and I say that because I find myself annoyed. Was never the basketball player that you were, but I played in high school and I never approached it with any sense of strategy. I would just go out there and, well, I hope I hit my shots, you know, like I hope I score. There wasn't any of the sort of analysis of, well, they're doing this, so I should do that, or I should practice this way or that way. And now I go, man, I wish when my ankles were better, when I was a little bit younger, I actually thought the game. Do you think about it that way, or were you just always thinking the game?
I have a massive, massive chip on my shoulder with basketball from that specific dynamic. And what I mean by that is my entire timeline as a basketball, as in my basketball development was shifted forward 10 years later than the majority of kids who get into basketball. Started playing literally when I was 16. So I was so far behind in terms of my development. And then not only that, I grew a ton. So I was basically Bambi when I was 16 and 17. I was 6'6", but I was probably 180 pounds. and just rail thin, and I wasn't athletic in any way, shape, or form. And then, like, literally when I was 19, I just kind of like grew into my body, and suddenly I was like freaky athletic, like elbow at the rim athletic type of player. And so then I was super raw, right? I was like this big athletic, you know, kind of forward, but I didn't have any of like the skill development piece. The one kind of thing was I was a streaky shooter, and that kind of carried me in college. Like, I had stretches where I was a really good shooter and stretches where I was a bad shooter, but that kind of carried me in the college level. And then I could defend and I could rebound. I was always a really good rebounder at the college level. But so I actually became obsessed with skill development post-college. There was a specific player, I won't shout him out in this particular environment so we don't go down that rabbit hole, but there was a player my last year who really kind of inspired me in terms of how to get to that next level. And I just kind of learned how to start training like a pro when it was too late. And so that, there's always a part of me that will wonder if I would have, you know, been like a kid that started playing when he was seven and, you know, worked through some of those development arcs earlier in my life, if something different would have happened. But at the same time, I'm at peace with it. And like, I still get a great amount of joy out of the game at this phase of my life, as just playing for fun. And honestly, it's almost like just a personal challenge. I just want to see the best basketball player that I can be for me. And that's literally all it is. But and then also like coaching has helped. Like I coach high school here in town as well. And that just kind of gives me another avenue to kind of pursue that competitively in terms of trying to like pursue team goals. Cause you know, what did you make of the JJ Redick report that he's interviewing for Charlotte?
Oh my God. I can't have Spike Eskin back on the podcast to complain about Redick again, but maybe because he's so entertaining when he does it. What did I make of it? To me, I look at it from the media perspective, namely, and that's the first place my mind went to. I frankly only care so much about the Charlotte Hornets. If they get good, I will start to really lock in on them. But it was odd to me that JJ has ascended to the top of media that he would want to do it. That was the first thought I had, because everybody is trying to get where he's at this point, and he's worked really hard to get there. He has put a lot of time and energy into that podcast, and through the musical chairs at ESPN, that's what people want. You do a game or two a week and you're on ABC. And if you can hold that position, that's just a beautiful spot to be in. So I think it might be reflective of his love of basketball if it's not enough for him. And it's that was my take on it, but I feel like you've got a take on it and I want your take on it.
I immediately just was like, I totally get it, because you know, what's interesting, like, this is the best job. It really is. Like even just from the perspective of what I do for the volume, like, I don't ever have to leave my house for work, you know, with exception of occasionally going to, you know, to like summer league and things like that. Yeah. So, but like, obviously JJ's is more involved because he does First Take from time to time and he travels for ESPN. And so his version of it is definitely more involved. But even within that lens, there's no doubt that if he took over as head coach of the Charlotte Hornets, his workload would probably triple and his level of stress every day would significantly increase. His travel schedule would get tougher. And like, at the same time, like, I just totally get it, because here's the thing, Ethan, like, I love my job and I love talking about basketball, but there's always a little part of me that feels dirty when I have to be critical of a player. I hate it. It's literally one of the worst parts of the job. You absolutely have to do it. It's one of the things that I think gets glossed over, especially by some of the media or some of the former players that are in media, that they act like you're trying to tell an NBA player how to do his job. That's not what it is. This job requires authenticity. It requires criticism in the same way that it requires praise. If you just have praise without criticism, your praise is empty. If you just have criticism without praise, your criticism is empty. You absolutely need to have that, right? But there is absolutely nothing like the team goal of going after let's just call it a Larry O'Brien in this case, going after the ultimate goal of winning the NBA championship. Like, there's just nothing like it. Like, I have been able to scratch the basketball itch in so many different ways after college, in terms of playing pickup and playing in money tournaments and coaching and at the high school level and all these different things. But like, there's just nothing that has been able to recapture that feeling I had when I was playing at Arizona Christian and we were a top five team in the nation and we were going into conference play and trying to jockey in the standings with Vanguard and Hope International and all these teams and going to the NIA tournament in Kansas City and rolling in deep with your team and going to dinners. And there's just nothing that captures that. And I just immediately thought JJ has the most amazing job in the world, but that's what he actually wants to do. He wants to be a part of a team and he wants to go after that goal. And I immediately was like, totally get it.
Yeah. Well, to be in variance, I think, is the deep human need to be in a situation with adrenaline where you don't know how it's going to end up. Now, it's different for coaches than players. Players, you're in variance moment to moment. I mean, I love that on my low level. You're talking about pickup. I play in a Sunday pickup game and I think about that damn game every day of the week, And that's a beautiful thing. Coaching. So playing, I guess that makes sense to me. If you were playing in the NBA, that sort of addiction makes total sense. Coaching makes less sense to me because there's just so much bullshit involved and people are undermining you and it seems frustrating. But at the same time, there's enough of it. It might be methadone for the heroin that you're missing because you're getting some of it. There's an energy. I remember with the Warriors, they would call it the pit, that sort of area where the coaches and the players are all in on the ground level of a game. And I just have these memories when we would sit with good seats in the playoff series, Memphis at FedEx, and the Warriors were down 1-2 in that first finals run. And I just remember, one of those relocation plays when it was still a little bit new that they were doing the Steph passes and then the relocate and the ball swings around, swings to Steph, three-pointer swish. And I just remember looking at Kerr and he just pumps the fist just like a madman. And hey, that might not be the same as when he actually hit a shot that mattered in the NBA finals, but there's just something there that they're addicted to. And I think that's why coaches are the second. They're often miserable, but the general managers are the most miserable. The only happy general manager I ever met was Daryl Morey. I think that there's something about being a general manager that's too much like what we do. It's too much in the outside of it. And people want to be in the pit, man. People want to be in the mix.
Yeah, I think that it's a lot more rewarding than people realize. So when I first started, I decided that I wanted to do it, and it was before I was with The Volume. And so the first season I did it, I was actually deeply involved and I was at practice every night and I was going to the games. And the only time I would take time off, I would take like occasional nights off to do State of the Lakers, right? At the end of the night. But for the most part, I was very involved. And when I started with The Volume, my role with the program has shifted towards, now I do skills training in the mornings and I primarily just focus on player development. But I will say that like, there is a form of fulfillment when you see a basketball player figure something out and take a leap, or when you see a basketball team kind of connect on a deeper level or figure something out. The wins and the losses and the grind from the coaching perspective, they're different than what it was like as a player, but I do think they're equally, if not more, rewarding. And I think JJ, I think, has been doing some coaching with his kid, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think he's gotten a little taste of that. And I think he wants to kind of transition that to the NBA level. But like, I do think there's more rewarding to it than people realize. You're right, though. There is a misery that comes from that relentless competitive energy and that constant state of dissatisfaction. Because that's the thing, like I will go to a game, a Sunday men's league game, and I'll have, you know, three big dunks and, you know, 20, 30 something points and we'll win by 15. And I'll get in the car and I'm just irritated about the three or four mistakes I made in that game. Mm. Like, it's just kind of like it's kind of like part of that process. But yeah, I totally sympathize with his desire there. Also, one last thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention his name as well among the people that I admired a ton in the early days. I'll just put it this way. I think JJ is the best in the world at what I do. Like, I think when I listen to him just in the weeds breaking down basketball games, I just think he's the best. I like, he's someone that I aspire to be more and more like. I think that he's going to be missed if he does go in the coaching route.
Hmm. Well, I mean, the work ethic is crazy. I think people don't understand how hard it is to book so many people and do those interviews. And he's combined it with the standing and the status of having been in that world, which then opens these guys up to giving answers that they wouldn't ordinarily give. I'm curious if you would actually do it, but Jeff Van Gundy was trying to get back in the mix for so many years when he was at ESPN, and so was Mark Jackson. There's clearly something addictive to the NBA circuit in a way that I can't totally relate to, frankly. I feel like, God, it's such a blessing to live a normal life versus the NBA life. That's my perspective on it. But I think it's hard because if so much of you has been defined by the NBA circuit as these guys were, and you've become a huge deal, paid a lot of money, and your love of the game helped get you there. What I've experienced is that the NBA, it's almost like it's this merry-go-round that is just, it's a merry-go-round that's going 50 miles an hour. That doesn't sound very appealing, but work with me on this analogy. Follow me on this one. It's a world that is overwhelming to the senses, and the rest of the world around it doesn't really exist that much. And when you're in it, you are in it and you feel like you are in it. But when you're out of it, you're not a part of it. And you feel that deeply. I felt it deeply when I quit my job and I started doing this, where I wasn't on the circuit anymore. And there's something to that, to being on the circuit. There's something to being able to go to any arena in America, just call somebody up, send an email, get in the game, basically, and then see a bunch of people I know at the arena and talk shop with them. And when it goes away, I think it's very easy to feel like you don't have a place in the world anymore. So even if these people have found a place in media, I think they've just been so conditioned to see the NBA circuit as the place where they fit in, which is why I don't know if you saw in Gilbert Arenas's podcast with the players who were talking about life after basketball. And there's just, for a lot of these guys, a real depression when they're out of the mix.
Yeah, it's like an empty feeling. I mean, it's kind of like we talked about earlier. There's no way to recreate that feeling. And in at the NBA level, like you said, it's just so much more involved that I can imagine it being even that much more jarring of a drop off. And honestly, I think that's going to be the barrier there, because you mentioned, I thought that was one of the most interesting things from the first couple episodes of the LeBron and JJ podcast, was when they talked about sacrifice, specifically when it pertains to their families. Because like that, for me personally right now, I'm very lucky to be deeply involved with my family and my social life, right? Like my wife and I spend a ton of time together. She's literally my best friend. We've got a friend group that we spend, you know, a couple days with every month. We've got all of my family, her family and my family lives in the Tucson area. So, you know, we're Friday night this week,
Do you have kids?
Not yet. So basically, like, we're so entrenched in this, and like, let's say, I don't have any delusions of grandeur. I don't think I'm going to be offered any coaching jobs anytime soon. But let's say that phone call were to come in, just theoretically, for the sake of this situation, like, yeah, I would be sacrificing all of that, like literally all of it, for a good chunk of the year. And like, yes, maybe I'd be able to make up some of it during the summertime. I can't even imagine at the college level, when you factor in recruiting and academic management and personality management and dealing with like literally kids, right? Like, I it is so deeply involved. And my guess is that's going to be the biggest barrier between JJ and anything involving him going into coaching, is that conversation with the family. Like, are you sure you want to do this? You know, like that sort of thing. But again, it's like, but if there's an ache in his chest to do it, I mean, that's also something that has to get factored in, you know?
It's why I think that maybe I'll try to coin this, not a midlife crisis. It's almost like a midlife boost, where people, I've seen people in media get more productive after their kids become old enough and maybe go off to college. I've seen, like, oh my God, Bill Simmons, it's a holiday and they just made a trade and he's got an emergency pod up immediately. Now, Bill Simmons has always been a beast content wise, but I think now that his kids are a little bit older, even if the conventional wisdom is as you age, you get less productive, you've got less energy, I think there's this tremendous boost that happens. And I think Steve Kerr got more into coaching when his kids were old enough. But when the kids are at an age where they're still coming into being who they are, that just seems extraordinarily difficult. I didn't have to have the commitment to be an immediate person that a coach or a player would, obviously. But one of the reasons why I quit my job in 2021 was because I could tell that my older son was becoming aware. And in the NBA, you've got to be occupied during the evenings. And that's when he's home, you know, in the West Coast, the early evenings. And I mean, there are trade-offs. And I guess certain families can make that trade-off and maybe have the support structure around it. But that's a real thing. It's a real thing that you can't just, it's not like doing the clips on YouTube where you can sell the cow and then sell parts of the cow. What's the word I'm looking for? Where is it, opportunity cost? It doesn't matter. We know what I'm talking about. You've got to take from somewhere to give to that world to succeed. There's just no way around it.
Yeah. And like, to that point, like, when my wife and I have kids, I'm really, really interested to see how that changes my approach to everything. Like right now I wake up every single day and my life is basketball. I wake up and I train the kids and then I come home and I do my show. And then when I'm done, I do my weight training and I do my skills training and I usually play some pickup. You know what I mean? And then I come home at night and my wife and I hang out and we do it again. Now, obviously during the playoffs, you could just add another chunk of time in the evening where we're working. But like, my entire life revolves around the game of basketball right now. And I'm really curious to see how that like just will like completely shift when a kid enters into the equation and suddenly my motivations change. And honestly, I think that'll just be another challenge in terms of like balancing that with my competitive energy surrounding the success of the show.
Well, the advantage you have as a media person versus a coach or a player is that you can choose when you work. I have two kids. It's not a crazy challenge versus larger families, but I do think I work my ass off. But the beauty of it is I can choose when I work my ass off. When I was on the NBA clock, when I was on that merry-go-round, I didn't have a choice about where I was, when I was. And that's unfortunate when it comes to the NBA, because there's a lot of hurry up and wait. There's a lot of show up to this practice. The doors could open at 11:30 and they could open at 2:30, but you'd better be there at 11:30. And you've got to be there throughout the night. You've got to be on the road. You can't choose. So in a way, I feel like I work harder now than I did back then, but I can actually be strategic about it. And obviously when my kids are home, that's when I'm not working. Now, I think Zach Lowe, what he used to do, he would watch the games in the morning. I find that very difficult as an idea. I feel like I want to be watching these as they're happening, but that just might be what you have to do if you have kids. You might have to become a morning watcher to be ultimately efficient.
Yeah, honestly, I actually prefer watching games in the morning for similar reasons. So, like, part of it too is like, I've been really fascinated with like the physiology of like the way that your awareness can shift over the course of a day. And like little things, like I've learned more about how like focused I am during certain parts of the day versus others. And like, honestly, like one of the things that I do a lot during the postseason is I take naps in the afternoon so that I'm more alert in the evenings. Because like during the regular season, when we do work randomly at night, one or two nights a week, like there are times when like it's 7:30 and I'm watching a game and like I really am like struggling to stay focused on like what I'm watching, yeah, just because it's a phase of the day where I'm typically unwinding. You know what I mean? And like in the morning, when I'm having my coffee, sitting down, watching film on Synergy, like I am so laser focused and I can be so efficient. And it's crazy to me because like I do like literally 4 hours of prep, if not more, every single day for a show. So I'll wake up at, you know, like 6:30, have a cup of coffee with my wife, and like 7, I start watching film. And like, I'll literally just watch film from 7 to 8 to 9 to 10. Like it just goes and goes and goes. But in that time, I can like really get to the bottom of what happened in a bunch of games because I can be really efficient and picky. The other part of it too is like, so the framework of Hoops Tonight is very much like telling the story of the game, right? I think of it like in terms of pickup basketball. Like, you know that feeling when you play a hard fought pickup basketball game that you win or lose, and you go to the sideline either to wait till the next game starts or till your turn is to come back up and get a rematch. And like you just immediately sit down and start obsessing about the pivotal plays where you won the game or the pivotal plays where you lost the game, right? Yeah. And so like I'm a big believer in targeting those for the show. Like for instance, in the Timberwolves Suns game last night, I was really focused on a second quarter stretch from Mike Conley that led to a coverage adjustment in the fourth quarter from Frank Vogel that Mike Conley barbecued in the start of the fourth quarter when they blew the game into double digits. And like I found that to be super fascinating, the way that like what Conley did in the second quarter literally led to what I thought was a mistake from Frank Vogel and a coverage adjustment that led to the win of the game, right? So like I can, on Synergy, I can like in the morning, I don't have to sift through 48 minutes of basketball. I target these specific stretches that are pivotal and I focus on them. And that allows me an element of efficiency that I can't get when I'm covering a game at night.
I mean, this cuts to the core of why you're successful, in my opinion, because there are a lot of people doing basketball content and you need to be able to cut through all of that noise to tell a story. And I think the mistake some people make, especially if they're knowledgeable and they're good at noticing and they're good at understanding aspects of strategy, is they want a peacock and they want to show that they know what this sort of offensive set is or that sort of offensive set is. And it all doesn't add up to much unless you can turn that into an easily digestible narrative, which I think you should be able to do, frankly. I am a big believer in the physicist Richard Feynman's aphorism that if you cannot explain something simply, then you do not understand it. It's not easy. It's not easy to explain a complex thing simply, but this was the guy who demonstrated how the Challenger blew up using a paper cup. So look, there are ways to explain things that make it digestible. And really, that's what coaching is at bottom, is that sort of communication and that sort of way of taking what seems very noisy and making it digestible. I think you do an excellent job of that. And it's not an easy job to make it easy, but that is the job. Now, what's complicated as I'm flitting around and free associating, it's hard to know what really matters. I'll give you an example, and I'd actually like your perspective on it. That game one between the Nuggets and the Lakers, I remember Nick Wright tweeted something like how the game was close and the Lakers were doing everything right until the third quarter where the Nuggets just pulled away. And my perspective on that particular game was that I disagreed with Nick. I felt like what actually happened is that the Lakers were getting badly outplayed and they were getting shelled from three-point land until the shots started dropping in the third quarter And then the separation that was always there revealed itself. So you can really take it in a variety of directions when you watch games. You can go with, well, here was the pivotal point where everything changed in some instances. And then in other instances, you can go with, this was always thus, and the variance just happened to finally correspond with the reality. It's hard to know, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, exactly. What's so interesting about it is this is what I love about this space is everyone kind of provides their own perspective. It's interesting because when I was younger, I used to get so caught up in all these debates and like, no, you're wrong and I'm right and here's why and blah, blah, blah. Just like classic, you know, the stupid, yeah, arrogant guy in his 20s kind of thing. And like, one of the things that I've grown to appreciate now is it's more just looking at it from different perspectives. So I have this like deep-seated basketball ideology. I'm going to steal a line from Mark Titus because he was the one who kind of pitched this originally to me, and I just love it. He says basketball is more art than science. And like, that is deeply entrenched in my belief system surrounding the game of basketball. So for instance, like, you're not going to hear me talk a ton about variance on my show, but at the same time, I'm not, you know, arrogant or stupid enough to think that that's not the case. And so I do follow and listen to people that take a more statistical approach to basketball to basically force that perspective on myself to try to learn more and more about that. And so, for instance, like I don't like looking at things in terms of a singular cause. I always look at them as like, there's a bunch of factors that are moving parts in these situations. And so, for instance, like, the Lakers Nuggets series, there has been some shooting variance. There's no doubt. Like, I mean, the Lakers just in game two in particular shot really, really well. And then obviously, the Nuggets missed a bunch of open looks, especially in that like third quarter stretch when the Lakers went up by 20. And like, that's certainly a part of it. But at the same time, like, there's no doubt that the Lakers came out in that game and brought a certain level of physical aggression and intensity that set a tone.
The Lakers played way better in game two than game one. I think there's no doubt about that. And to what you're saying, the Nuggets also had a ton of misses that rimmed in and out. And what's tricky here is that variance is a thing and luck is a thing, but it's so easy sometimes to adopt a loser's mentality and lean on that. You almost can't, whether you're making content about the game or actually participate in trying to win the game, simply attribute results to variance and luck and sample size and everything else. That just can't, you almost, it's funny, to get lucky in life, you need to proceed as though luck doesn't exist. It's a strange thing that way.
That's you put it so well. Like that's literally the way I look at it. Like, there's no doubt that it's a factor. It's just borderline pointless to talk about. And like, and so like, I'll make a reference of it. Perfect example is like the Pacers. The Pacers are a top five jump shooting team in the NBA by efficiency, and the Bucks are a top five team in allowing jump shot looks, right? So like, game one, the Pacers literally could not make a jump shot to save their lives. And it was obvious that they were nervous and tense and like, they just couldn't buy a bucket. So then they go into game two, they get, I want to say they were like 0.77 points per jump shot in game one. Game two was like 1.22 points per jump shot. So like, a substantial leap in jump shot efficiency from game one to game two. There's no doubt that variance played a certain amount of like role in it, right? But in terms of the locker room, how do you think Rick Carlisle and those guys handled that? It was probably more like this. Like, guys, don't be nervous. Relax. Trust your abilities. Trust your hard work. Go out there and knock shots down. That's the way you approach it. You don't come out of there like, we got unlucky tonight, and then you leave game two and go, we got lucky tonight. And like, and that's kind of the thing. And like, even when you dig into it, like, so for instance, in the third quarter run of game two of Lakers Nuggets, in addition to the Nuggets missing a bunch of jump shots, the Lakers were missing a bunch of layups. LeBron missed like 3-point blank layups at the rim. Anthony Davis missed one. Rui Hachimura missed a dunk. And like, so there's certainly an element of like, man, are we really missing these easy, easy shots? But if you dig into a little bit, it's like, well, if Aaron Gordon's guarding LeBron and Jokic is coming to the level of the screen and there's a pocket pass to AD, who's on the back line? And it's like, oh, those and ones were against Jamal Murray tagging the roller. Now Aaron Gordon shifts to AD and Jokic shifts to Rui and KCP's on LeBron. Now Jokic comes up to the level. You're throwing the pocket pass to Rui, and now Aaron Gordon is on the back line. It's a completely different athlete. It's a completely different challenge. That probably plays a bigger role in those layups making or missing than the luck element. And so, like, I think just focusing on that gets silly, and it's, and certainly from the perspective of the process of the teams, it doesn't make any sense to really approach.
It's interesting to see how this progresses for people, because I am more inclined to view results as having a cause divorced from luck. I am aware of luck, but the older I get, the more I can see some kind of reason. I was talking about it with an NBA GM with the Niners, where they had the Super Bowl, and one of their best defensive players, Greenlaw, just goes out to start a defensive possession, not even in the course of play, and he blows out his, I think, ACL or Achilles. I can't remember which one. Yeah.
That was nasty.
Yeah, it was bad. It was Achilles. Yeah, it's Achilles. He blows it out. And I look at that. When I see something like that, I think there's a response, a reaction of, oh my God, what a freak injury. How unfortunate. I look at that as that's some sort of flaw, some sort of the team didn't recognize something. Somebody wasn't doing something properly because nothing was happening there. And the guy's Achilles exploded. That's got to be something that's on somebody. That can't be looked at as a freak injury. But the NBA GM I was talking to totally disagreed. And he said, no, that's freak injury. That's bad luck. And it is hard to know in many instances. People talk about injury luck. I am more likely to look at injuries the way I look at basketball, which is there's an element of variance, there's an element of luck, but better shots result in better outcomes. Better process results in better outcomes. So when I see teams repeatedly have the same injury misfortune, we might say, I am more inclined to go, what is their training process? Because if we're just going to attribute it all to luck, then what are these guys getting paid for? What's the training staff getting paid to do if it's just all a roll of the dice? But people see it differently and they have different perspectives on it. And ultimately, we can never really prove how much is process and how much is fortune.
So I do think that there are some athletes, I think this is clear, there are some athletes that just have a more durable body for whatever reason. Like, I think we can all agree that, like, LeBron James just structurally as a human being is more durable than some of the other athletes around the league, right? Like that goes without saying. But I do think I'm actually deeply fascinated by this because I just went through an Achilles injury, not an Achilles tear, but I had a severe case of Achilles tendonitis that caused me to basically stop playing for like 5 months. But around the same time, it was like Aaron Rodgers tore his Achilles, and then two of my buddies tore their Achilles. And so, like, there was one that happened right in front of me. He went to just follow his own shot his own shot, went down in a pile, and he tore his Achilles. And so around the time that I started feeling the discomfort that I was feeling, I went over to him and I was like, hey man, like, what can you tell me a little bit about how you were feeling leading up to the Achilles injury? And it was so interesting. He's like, yeah, dude, it was sore. He's like, I vividly remember I was sitting on the chair. I was sore. I wanted to take some more time to warm up, but just because of the way it shaped out with when the game started and me being in the first 10, like, I just walked out there and played and it went. For the other buddy that tore his, he said he was feeling soreness in his calf muscle in the time leading up to the injury. And so, like, I tend to think it's like a little bit of both. Like, there's certainly a luck element to it. There's certainly like a natural physiology element to it. But I do think that there's an athlete pride element where you have a tendency to deal with the pain for a while before you take it seriously. And I think there are just some people who end up pushing that too far. Like, I played on my bad Achilles for a while before I finally was like, no, I need to chill out. And honestly, what helped me was seeing a couple of my friends tear theirs, because it kind of gave me the appropriate amount of fear that I needed to address that. But like, it is, I do find that fascinating. Cause I think like, I think honestly, like it probably is about, over communication with your medical staff and making sure that you're like managing soreness on a daily basis to try to address that. And like, I do think that it's worth talking about medical staffs in these instances in a lot of cases.
And in a Super Bowl setting, you kind of have to roll the dice too.
Yeah.
It's not a situation where you go, oh yeah, we'll try it in week 19. So maybe it was a calculated risk. I don't know. I saw my neighbor Desmond, I was playing with him over a year ago and he blew out his Achilles, and I needed to create a narrative in my mind about why it happened, because otherwise I wouldn't want to play basketball, because Desmond's a personal trainer. He is in peak shape. So I just saw a guy who's in way better shape than I am. And all he did was shot fake and drive and boom. And ultimately the narrative in my head is that Desmond never takes a playoff. That was the lesson I learned from it. And not only that, you know, not only does he never take a playoff, he's always on you like a personal trainer about when you're being lazy in a game of 21 and not going full tilt. But I don't know if that's why it happened to Desmond, but I needed to tell myself some sort of reason, because otherwise it feels too scary. Like you're a gazelle going across the river with crocodiles and it's just going to happen to you. So that's another aspect where I'm not sure if my disregard of luck is more rooted in trying to be correct, or if it's more rooted in just trying to feel comfortable and feel like there's some sort of organization to reality and that bad things can't just happen out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, the concept of the loser mentality is such an aggressive, it's such an aggressive way to put it. But I always look at referencing luck as kind of a loser's mentality. And I hate that phrase. I think it's too aggressive. But like, there is something about chaos versus control when it comes to your own personal ambitions. And in order to be driven on a daily basis, you have to feel like you're in control. If you don't, yeah, then there's nothing to really like push you. And so from that standpoint, like I think disregarding luck is more a matter of just the daily motivational battle you have with yourself and having that control. And so like, again, it's more of a mindset than a belief. Like I thoroughly believe that luck exists within the realm of basketball. I just personally have a hard time focusing on it or referencing it repeatedly because of the fact that I think that it's just kind of pointless. It's not a useful use of your time.
There's just a lot there too when it comes to injury and it comes to why things happen. I think way more about fatigue than I used to. That's something when I was a kid, I don't know how you watch basketball. I had zero concept of fatigue when I was a kid watching NBA games. It was just, they're playing out there. They're screwing up. They're not screwing up. Now there's far more of a sense of it, of Anthony Davis put all of his life force into that first half. And now he does not have a lot left. And that's why we're seeing the results that we see. When I think about injury luck in the context of fatigue, the 2016 Warriors versus the Cavs is an interesting one to look back on, because if people would recall, the Warriors famously up 3-1 in that series. Draymond does something in other regions to LeBron, gets suspended. I am convinced that the Warriors had some sort of internal sense of how much life force they needed to spend to get to their goal when they were winning 73 games and finally pushing to the playoffs. And I don't think it's a coincidence that after that happened, Bogut gets hurt, Andre's back gets hurt. I felt like what had happened is that they had the finish line in their sights, and then all of a sudden the suspension comes for Draymond and they lose the next game. And it's almost like, I mean, can you imagine running a marathon and somebody comes out right when you see that tape and they go, well, actually another mile is being added. Your body is probably going to break down in that circumstance. And so that's one where I feel like there's something there. There's something to the breakdown of the team physically had something to do not only with the season being extended to a certain point, but the season being extended past the point where they had an internal expectation is what caused the breakdown.
I think this is super fascinating because I read your article about the physicality in the NBA and the platonic score of 100 to 100 and I found it deeply fascinating because I have been so interested in how tired everyone looks in these games in this playoff.
Yeah.
Everyone looks exhausted because that extra layer of physicality, because like, not only is the league gotten more physical in this concept, in the context of the regular season, I even feel like this postseason is more physical than last year's postseason was. And I think it's really under discussed because there are a lot of basketball fans too. They'll be like, why didn't he drive every single possession? Why didn't he do this every single possession? And it's like, there is a, I'm sure you remember this feeling even, or you know of this feeling just from playing pickup on Sundays, but like there's this point you get to as a basketball player. It's almost like you get tired and you can recover. You can get tired and you get recovered. But when you like push past a certain point, it's like you can't regain that like verve that you had in the early portion of the game. I thought a perfect example of this was Anthony Davis against Jokic in game two. Early in the game, he was holding his ground, matching his physicality and really causing problems for him on the ball. And then those last two Jokic post-ups, he went through him like tissue paper. Like he wasn't even there. And you could just tell AD's energy level just cratered over the course of that game. And I think like, I think it's honestly under discussed. I actually talked about this in my show last night because I found it really fascinating that Luka in that game last night is like sliding his feet and containing Paul George off the dribble, but also like having the leg strength to rise up and hit shots. Like even LeBron and just what he had in the tank at the end of game two against Denver, like those, I think it's Steph, it's the most underrated thing about Steph in his career is his conditioning and how he can kind of hold up under fatigue. But yeah, I think it's a really under-discussed element of the success of a lot of these guys. And honestly, to your point about injuries, it could be one of the most under-discussed elements of injury prevention is being conditioned to maintain those movements.
I think one of the reasons why I think about fatigue more is honestly Steve Kerr, who Warriors fans might not like certain decisions he makes with the lineups, but I think he knows a thing or two about winning at the NBA level. I think I could say that much. And it informed how I saw a series because I remember when the Warriors went down 2-3 to the Rockets some years ago on one of those old KD teams. I can't remember if we're talking, I think it was maybe 2018 is what we're talking about. I remember we went in the locker room. I think it might have been myself, maybe Anthony Slater. Everybody else had cleared out and Steve was there and they've just gone down 2-3. And he told us it was not for attribution, but he told us, yeah, we're going to win the series. We're going to win the series. And here's how we're going to win it. They're exhausted. And the threes they shoot, I mean, that's what people don't know with a guy like Harden is that every time you dribble, you're spending some energy when you do that. It's not easy to see from the outside, but it's just, that's not just casual. That's not just casual. And he definitely had this philosophy that a series was not a situation like we're playing rock, paper, scissors, where, okay, you won this one, then I won that one. No, a series is more like, it's more like a boxing match where one guy gets to the point of fatigue. And at that point you could just tap him over. It's a situation. And when you think about a lot of series, there are series where it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But the way those old Warriors teams played, they played to exhaust you. They played collectively sharing the ball at a high pace for back then. And the idea is at a certain point in this series, you are going to be done and we're going to take over the series. And that's how a lot of those Warriors series went, where there was a little bit of a volley, a little bit of back and forth between them and the Grizzlies. And then it's just takeover time because the many hands makes the work light approach to their offense turned into a situation where they would just overwhelm the team that was very star centric and very much, I'm just going to dribble, 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 high pick and roll. And I never really had thought about a basketball series in that way until being around them. But I think it's true. I think there's something to it, that a lot of winning a playoff series is as much about energy management as it is anything else.
I 100% agree. I thought 2017 that series felt a lot like that too. It was like Kyrie and LeBron could go toe to toe with the Warriors for two or three quarters, but eventually just the fatigue element of them creating every shot off the bounce versus the five out motion attack generating offense for the Warriors, it just was unsustainable, especially with the talent gap that they were dealing with. And like in general, I think we don't talk about this enough as it pertains to shot value. And this is something that where I actually disagree with Daryl Morey and some of his approach. When it comes to that Houston Rockets team, for instance, there's so much focus on the shot value of the three-point shot. And, oh, we missed 27 straight and so on and so forth. But like, to me, the playoffs are so much more about the small sample than the large sample. And there are certainly value adds that you get from targeting three-point shots in the large sample. So for instance, over an 82 game regular season, if you attempt a lot of threes, you're going to win a lot of games. If you build your defensive scheme around chasing teams off the three-point line, you're going to win a lot of games by winning that like analytical battle. But this is what I find so fascinating about Denver. They take a lot of twos between the rim and the three-point line, between Jamal Murray's pull-up twos that he takes and Jokic taking his little, you know, short yeah. little push shots and floaters in that 10 to 15 foot range. But it's like all of a sudden it goes from being a points per possession in the aggregate type of question into like, what's your field goal percentage on this possession? Like, what shot can you get to right here that you can make a high percentage of the time? And like Jamal Murray, he shot 46% this year on pull-up jump shots, not effective field goal percentage, just straight up field goal percentage. Like he's going to make half of them. And so, and Nikola Jokic, we know shoots in the high 60s, low 70s on basically everything around within 10 feet of the rim, right? So like there's a certain small sample advantage that Denver gains. And when you looked at Denver's offensive numbers this year, they actually weren't exceptional in terms of like the offensive rating compared to some of the other teams around the league. But who's the team you trust to execute offensively down the stretch, the team that can in a singular possession get high quality shots? You know,
you reminded me of the other thing that Steve said after that game five. The other thing he mentioned is that Chris Paul got hurt in that series, if you remember. And he said, look, James Harden is obviously the more dynamic player, but Chris is the one who fucks us up more because we have to guard the whole floor. And he's going to shoot that little mid-range shot. And it's not that that mid-range shot is so potent. It's just that there is something to keeping the defense honest. If we know that all of you guys are about behind the arc or trying to get the layup, then there's a predictability to that that we can structure the defense around and we can attack you. But if there is something that you're throwing into the mix that we have to guard, we can't just let Chris Paul take a wide open 15 footer. We can't do that. He's going to make it above 50%. Then that breaks the defense down in a way that's subtle. So you can't, this is almost like the audience capture. And a lot of things are like this where you can't just max out and optimize completely. It's not going to completely work. You need an overall mix and an overall quality, or you're going to come up short when it really matters.
Yeah, the James Harden step back three is the perfect example of this. Over 82 games, when he's seeing a different perimeter defender every single night, like no one, the next guy in line is not ready for James Harden's step back and his crossover move and his hesitation, you know, hard dribble drive to the left. And so he'll take, you know, let's just say a round number. He'll take 500, you know, pull up threes over the course of the season. And like, you just break it down on a points per possession basis. And it's like, this is the most efficient scorer of all time. He's getting 1.2, whatever points per ISO. And he's getting, but then it's like, then you break it down into the small sample and it's like, actually, okay, now he's going consistently against a top tier perimeter defender who's seeing him every single possession down the floor for 2 weeks. and you're in, and the physicality and intensity is, has ratcheted up, all of a sudden it's like actually a step back three where you not only need to get separation from the defender, but you need to get the appropriate lift to knock down the shot. And like I say this on the show all the time, like I take a lot of pull-up jump shots when I play basketball. It's kind of the way that my game is structured. Like those shots are actually more taxing on the lower body than a drive in a lot of ways, because you have to reestablish your base while you're moving. There's a footwork element to it, and then you have to get lift to get the shot off against that defensive player. And so like when you start to break down the points per possession of a James Harden pull-up three, when you get into the small sample, all of a sudden it becomes untenable. And to your point, like that's where variety and field goal percentage kind of come to the surface in the postseason. And that's why like playoff shots, those like the ability to knock down the tougher shots become more valuable. But now you can skew really far in that direction to become the Phoenix Suns, and then you have your own set of issues. But like I think that is fascinating.
Yeah, I think the analytics people almost got too strident in their case against the mid-range jumper because the athletes were too attached to the mid-range jumper. And ultimately, I always make the analogy to pitching, where look, it's really a matter of, yes, the analytics are probably correct that you should throw more of your most effective pitch, but you can't always throw that pitch. So that's really what we're talking about here. Let the analytics be your guide in order to get more efficient, but you can't completely max it out. Once you max it out, then it becomes a bit of an issue for the reasons that that we're describing right now. I could talk to you all day. I know you've got a lot of things you have to attend to in your 4-hour preparations for your YouTube videos. This has been fantastic, Jason. Where can everybody find you to check out the content you're producing right now?
No, man, this has been a blast. I hope we can do it again sometime in the future. Obviously, the YouTube channel is Hoops Tonight. The podcast feed is Hoops Tonight. And then I'm on Twitter at @JasonLT. That's my primary social platform. I'll do show announcements and I'll tweet like an angry fan there sometimes. But those are the general places you can find me.
Oh, this has been great. Would love to do it again. Thanks so much, man.